Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Verrill. And today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor and employment law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the proposed Protecting the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, and the top 10 elements of the act that employers should keep at top of mind. Welcome, Rob, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tani. Just by way of a little additional background on me, I'm the vice chair of the firm's labor and employment department, and I've been with the firm almost 30 years. And during that time, I have focused my practice on labor and employment work, and in particular on union issues that is really the focus of the PRO Act. And so this is a very interesting piece of proposed legislation for someone like me who has spent a lot of time trying to learn the existing framework for labor relations in this country. And as you'll hear, this statute or proposed law is going to represent a lot of changes for employers if it passes.
Rob, you know, one of the interesting things I always find about labor law is that it is very distinct from employment law. So while we talk generally about labor and employment law and the work that you and I both do, I'll be honest to everyone, you know, I don't do labor work. And in part, I always find it so interesting to learn more about the process. And one of the things that I find so interesting and frustrating is how ever-changing the world of labor law is. For our listeners who have a unionized workforce, you already probably know some of this headache, but Rob, for those of our listeners who aren't in a unionized environment, can you discuss just a little bit generally how labor law is made or created? We know we have the National Labor Relations Act, but otherwise, I feel like some days we're telling employers you can't have a policy that says no recording on site. And then 4 years later, when we have a new administration, we're saying, nope, actually you can. That's permissible again. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how labor law generally is created?
Sure. Well, the labor law environment in this country, as you pointed out, rests on what's called the National Labor Relations Act. And it was created during the Depression years, the 1930s, after several decades of some pretty tumultuous years of labor management relations. There's a lot of labor strife, some pretty notorious riots, security gangs hired by big industrialists to go out and beat up the workers. There was some pretty amazing and historic fights, if you will, between labor and management. And so the National Labor Relations Act was a way to try to organize this in a way to keep people from hurting each other. And so what it does is it provides employees the right to organize, to engage in concerted activity and be protected by the law. And so this statute very simply says employees can band together for the purposes of engaging in discussions with their employer about the terms and condition of employment. And so labor unions come in as an organization to represent these workers, and labor unions have independent standing to come in and say, hey, to the employer, we want to represent these employees. And then the employees have a right to exercise their own free choice as to whether they are going to be represented by the union or not. So the NLRA protects not only an employee's right to be in a union, it also protects an employee's right not to be in a union. And so it lays out this general framework about what the rules are. And so it's governed by a 5-member board that is appointed by the president, and they have staggered terms. And so the majority of the board is going to be controlled essentially by the party of the president. And so this, this accounts for the swings of policy that we see at the board every time a new party takes control of the White House and creates a lot of frustration for employers. Like, well, how come I've got new rules this year about recording in the workplace or use of email or picketing, you know, when we just did our handbook 2 years ago over because you told us to, Tawny and Rob. So there's a lot of frustration there, but that's why this board, you know, this agency is somewhat more political than some of the other agencies. And one other source of uncertainty and variability at the board is the way it goes about setting policy. Unlike many agencies, the board historically does not issue rules or have a whole set of regulations, like say the EPA would have about what's, you know, clean water and clean air and things like that. What the board does is it issues decisions of about controversies arising under the act. And so it gets a set of facts on, and we'll hear about some of them today, say, the right of employees to organize, who's going to be a supervisor, for instance. And so the board looks at those facts and they issue a decision based on the facts as to whether somebody is or isn't, say, a supervisor. And that's their interpretation of the act. And so what happens frequently is that the next administration comes along, maybe it's a different party, that same set of facts or similar facts goes up to the board and they come out with the opposite decision. And so you have this swinging back and forth between administrations, if you will, of different decisions from the board. And what you've got after, say, you know, 75 years or so of decisions is that no matter what position you've got in labor law, you can almost always find a board decision to support it. And that drives people like me crazy, drives employers crazy, because it's hard to predict what's going to happen. And I think your best way of predicting what's going to happen is, okay, which party controls the White House? You know, and is that a pro-management or a pro-union? And right now, as we'll talk about in a minute, we are definitely in a pro-union environment.
So it's interesting because while so much of the law is then created by these board decisions, the PRO Act isn't a board decision. This is a statute that we're going to be looking at that would have the same strength or power as the National Labor Relations Act itself, correct?
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the things why it's such a potentially momentous piece of legislation, is that it takes, in many important areas of labor law, it takes what at least in almost every case is would be a very pro-labor board decision, and it now makes it part of the law. So the next board can't easily reject it. So essentially this is going to codify, in many respects, the pro-labor board decisions going back however many years, many of them from the Obama administration period.
So with that background, let's jump into it, Rob. I mean, we've got a lot of information. So we've got 10 things that I think individuals should keep there at top of mind. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the proposed Protecting the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, and the top 10 elements of the act that employers should keep in mind. Now, within the PRO Act, Rob, there appears to be an erosion of some of the distinctions between what an employee is, an independent contractor, and a supervisor. As many of our listeners may know, only employees and not managers or supervisors or independent contractors traditionally can be members of a union. Does the PRO Act change the standard in any regard?
You bet. it represents a very significant change in the way employees are classified, and, you know, namely who can be in a union. And so by way of preview, basically this is going to expand the pool of workers who can be considered employees under the National Labor Relations Act, and therefore who can join the union. And so it's important to note that the current law only protects employees, but excluded from employees are supervisors. So who's a supervisor? The National Labor Relations Act actually has a definition of a supervisor. And essentially a supervisor under the act is someone who can hire, fire, discipline, assign work, oversee, and otherwise direct other workers with independent judgment and discretion, and they're sort of do so responsibly, or they're responsible for other workers. And if they meet any one of those elements, they're a supervisor, and by definition, they're not an employee, and they cannot be in the union. And the reason for that policy-wise is that Congress didn't want to have workers of a company who had divided loyalties. So they were expected to be loyal to management. But if they were in a union, if you look at a union constitution, pretty much every single union constitution demands that its members be loyal to the union. So how can a person be loyal to the union, which represents the workers, and be loyal to the company at the same time? And so Congress said, we're not going to put people in that position. And so we're going to have a bright line. And so over the years, the definition of supervisor has been interpreted many, many different times. And it's been a very hot topic over the years, in part because both the unions and the companies, they want the supervisors, especially those frontline supervisors, they want them on their side. Why? Because supervisors, those frontline supervisors, are the best campaigners if there's a union organizing campaign. Because if you're a supervisor, you're going to have influence over your subordinates. And if you're part of management, then management can rely on the supervisors to communicate management's message about not wanting a union, typically, or at least just management's position generally. But if the supervisor doesn't want to communicate that message to the rank and file, if you will, they can get fired for that. And there's no recourse for that supervisor under the National Labor Relations Act. You know, they breach their duty of loyalty to management. But if they're in the union, if they're an employee as under the definition, then essentially the management has lost one of its best campaigners in a union organizing campaign. And indeed, the union has gained a really good campaigner, because what we see in lots of industries, you know, healthcare is one example, like charge nurses. You know, is a charge nurse a supervisor or an employee? And again, both sides want that person on their side. Employers are like, well, if they're a charge nurse, they're in charge. That makes them a supervisor. And unions are like, well, no, they don't have real authority. They just follow the manual, and they don't have any, you know, they don't have any final authority. You know, if somebody gets disciplined, that goes up to the nurse manager or higher management. So they should be members of the union. We litigated that case once, that issue, for over a 7-year period for one union organizing campaign. And in the meantime, we had a couple different decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court on the definition of a supervisor. I mean, it's a real hot topic. But what this bill would do would essentially move the goalposts, or redefine the whole statute in terms of who's a supervisor. And it does it in a couple different ways that are pretty significant. One is that it adds a brand new requirement to be a supervisor. Namely, if you're looking at those supervisors' duties, what do? Do they hire? Do they fire? Do they discipline? Do they direct? Do they assign? They need to be doing that function for a majority of their work time, which is a really high bar in many industries. Often you'll have frontline supervisors who are doing the work, you know, doing sort of work that's similar to the people they supervise, but they're responsible for it. And historically, that would be, you know, enough to have supervisory status. But this new requirement of doing that work, those duties for a majority of your time, is designed to really shrink the pool of eligible supervisors. And then this PRO Act would also take away from the definition a couple indicia of supervisory status, one of which is assigning work. So that would be removed. And also taking away the responsibility to direct the work of others. So again, they've just shrunk the definition in such a way as to make it a lot harder for employers to classify workers as supervisors.
And I think it's important to note here too that this is not an industry specific statute. This is all industries without regard to the type of work that is performed or product or service that is set forth for the public, which makes this all encompassing, which in certain situations, I think it creates some interesting operational dynamics. I mean, how are you going to have a meeting with senior managers regarding working with or discussions with the union or bargaining issues when you're literally sitting in the same room with members of the union? So I think that is going to create some interesting dynamics should we see the PRO Act be passed.
That's right. Think layoffs. Let's talk about who's going to get laid off. Now you're inviting a member of the union into the meeting to decide who gets laid off. So yeah, there's lots of complications. And the PRO Act doesn't just stop at redefining what a supervisor is. It also will redefine independent contractors who could be excluded. Again, the NLRA just talks about employees being eligible to be members of the union. If somebody is an independent contractor, they're not an employee, so they can't be in a union. So this status of independent contractor has been hotly litigated and debated all over the country in both the states and at the federal level. And so the PRO Act incorporates something that comes from California. It's called the ABC test, which is actually in most states in some form or fashion. And like, for instance, in unemployment, people have heard the ABC test. But the ABC test is basically a very restrictive test when it comes to classifying someone as an independent contractor.
And I think that this becomes one of the really interesting aspects is that we're looking at now, you know, NLRA having this different definition from all the other different standards that might be in effect, the EOC standards, state law standards, unemployment, workers' comp. I mean, as our listeners are hearing, there is a ton to this, and that's only one element of it. So we are going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the proposed Protecting the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, and the top 10 elements of the act to keep in mind. Now, Rob, before the break, we were talking about how the PRO Act erodes some of the distinctions between employers, independent contractors, supervisors. I mean, we ended talking about independent contractors, but it's my understanding that there's also a joint employer element to this. Can you give us a little more detail about that?
You bet. Yeah, the joint employer issue has been another one of these hotly debated issues over the last decade, namely, if you can one employee have more than one employer? And the answer has flip-flopped depending on which party controls the White House and therefore the board. The PRO Act would purport to make it a lot easier for an employee to have two employers. And so this is really an important issue in businesses like franchises. So like McDonald's is the parent or the franchisor, the franchisee is the local restaurant owner. typically those workers organize, it's just against the franchisee, the local owner, and McDonald's isn't in it. But this rule would actually make it easier for unions to drag in McDonald's in that case, because as long as they've got some indirect control over the business, then they can be dragged in, which makes negotiating a contract really complicated. Which entity is going to decide how much wages they're going to pay? I mean, so it's a real thicket. But we won't spend a lot of time on that. But that would be a really significant change if that happens.
Rob, we've heard also, I mean, so we just spent a lot of time talking just about one specific element of it. I mean, but that was a really meaty topic between who is an employer, who is a supervisor, what is an employee. I've heard that the PRO Act will end something that's called state right to work laws. I mean, don't we all have the right to work? What's a right to work law, and how is the PRO Act going to affect those state laws?
Sure. Yeah, the right to work laws, yeah, it's a strange label for it because it's so general, and it seems like, I mean, how could anybody argue with that proposition? I should have a right to work, right? But what it boils down to is if you're in a work for an employer that has a union in place representing the workforce, can the employer, through bargaining with the union, include a requirement in the contract that you have to pay union dues if you're a member of the bargaining unit? And the current National Labor Relations Act allows states to create exceptions, saying if a state wants to, they can say, as a condition of working, you are not required to pay union dues. And there's a lot of states that have done it. The majority, 27 states, have elected to allow employees to opt out of having to pay union dues, even if the union otherwise represents them. Most of those states are kind of in the middle of the country, in the Southeast and the West, but not the far West. So it's interesting. It kind of matches the blue-red divide recently. The closest state to Maine is, well, I think it's now Ohio, but it's not close to, but the Northeast is pretty much allows unions and employers to make employees pay dues as a condition of employment. This part of the Pro Act would abolish states' ability to do that. So what this means is that unions are going to make a lot more money because nobody can opt out of paying dues.
Well, in addition to making a lot more money, I think there becomes some really big concepts of state rights and that comes out of this, in the same way that we see places that are unlegislated, where states take action, state legislation, to be looking at 27 states that could have their statutes overruled or overthrown by the PRO Act is big news, I think. So that's the second element. We need employers to keep it top of mind. Let's jump to the third element. And the third element is about what the term that the National Labor Relations Act or the union and labor attorneys seem to use is quickie elections. So I'm reading that the PRO Act is going to bring back quickie election procedures. What does that exactly mean?
So when a union wants to organize a bunch of employees for a particular employer, there's a process for that. And the board process for about 50 years had a pretty deliberate way of going about it. The union would file a petition, then the employer had about a week to respond, and the petition would deal with would address when the election was going to be, who should be in the unit. And these rules, or at least the practice, was such that it took at least 45 days, plus or minus, for the election to be held. And the unions hated that because during those 45 days, the employers usually kicked into gear their opposition to the union organizing campaign. And they would have meetings with the employees and basically tell the employees why they shouldn't join the union, why they shouldn't bring in the union. And so during the Obama administration, the board actually issued a rule that essentially shrunk that time to about 20 days, plus or minus. They limited the issues that could be addressed prior to the election. And so that then was the beginning of this phrase, quickie election, because 20 days is just not enough time for most employers to respond to a union organizing campaign. They just can't get their act together in time. But the only things they can do to deter employees from organizing a union is to do the illegal stuff, like firing people or threatening them with their jobs. And the unions are okay with that because that's illegal activity. And then they helps them with their campaign. They can say their employer is a lawbreaker. So employers have hated this quickie election rules. The Trump administration board didn't do away with it altogether, but they essentially relax the rules to allow a little more time. But this part of the PRO Act would essentially go back to the Obama era and make it a very short time frame between the filing of a petition and when the election has to be held.
So that third element is kind of this bringing back of quickie elections, shortening that time period that's in place as to when notice is provided and when the election is held. In the same vein, when we're talking about steps that employers can take during the union organizing process, the fourth element that I've seen mentioned a lot is blocking charge policies, and that employers, how they use a blocking charge policy. So what is a blocking charge policy? And then in addition, how will the PRO Act change how employers currently use it in union organizing?
Sure. Well, yeah, blocking charge historically was a way for employers to slow down the election by essentially accusing the union of engaging in some unlawful activity. It was also a way for a union to slow down the election. Let's say the union thought they were going to be losing the election because of the employer's actions, so they could file what's called an unfair labor practice charge with the board. And the charge would have to be resolved before the election was held. And so both sides would use this blocking charge as a technique to delay, if you will. And the recent, actually the PRO Act is, and the quickie election rules relate to this in the sense that in the quickie election rules essentially stripped the employer's ability to file blocking charges. And so there were very limited ability, one less tool for employers to slow down the election. And again, the PRO Act also has some other really fundamental changes to how employers can act during a union campaign. It actually bans employers from having mandatory meetings with employees over their management position on unionizing. That would be perceived as a pretty significant infringement on employers' free speech rights. The PRO Act would also essentially implement what was called the persuader rule that was proposed during the Obama years. Essentially, it would require companies to disclose how much money they're spending on union anti-union activities, whether it's consultants or lawyers. So essentially, it's a great tool for unions to say, hey, if they're going to spend umpteen $1,000s on, you know, union busting lawyers and consultants, they can at least afford, you know, a 20-cent per hour raise for you guys. Really good stuff for organizing for the employer. And also has this neutrality language that the employers basically have to sit back and they can't interfere with the employees dealing with the unions. I mean, really monumental sea change stuff for labor management relations. And when it comes to blocking charges, again, this is sort of goes to the tail end. How does a group of employees get rid of a union? There is a way to do that. They have an election. You know, you can have an election to bring them in and you can have an election to get them out. The election rules to decertify a union under the PRO Act would become somewhat limited, and this at least would make it harder for employees to get rid of a union. And in terms of, it used to be that, with the employer side, the PRO Act would make it very hard to file a blocking charge. But on the decertification process, unions can file blocking charges to delay the decertification vote. So this essentially allows unions to get embedded. So they can accuse the employer of unlawfully interfering with the employee's decertification vote. And unlike an employer charge, which can't block an election, the PRO Act would say, that's okay for unions to block the decert election. And we'll just wait for as long as it takes to resolve the unfair labor practice charge before we have that election.
So it seems like unions are getting the best of both worlds from that standpoint as to those two elements, both decertifying and preparing to certify or to vote for a union.
That's one way to look at it.
For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show, and I'm your host, Tani Alvarez. And today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the proposed Protecting the Right to Organize, or PRO Act, and the top 10 elements of the act that employers should keep in mind. We've gone through the first four elements, but let's jump into two more, Rob. Let's do five and six. So it's my understanding that currently, if a labor pool strikes, that the employer, when these all of these employees strike, an employer has a right to permanently replace employees who strike. Does the PRO Act change that in some way?
It sure does, in a huge way. The PRO Act would essentially prohibit an employer from hiring permanent replacements. And what a permanent replacement is, you know, let's say the union goes on strike, the company has a right to continue to run its business, so they can hire workers who can work there permanently. And if the union stops the strike, they do have a right of sort of a first refusal. So if an opening happens at the mill or the plant or the whatever the facility is, then the union has a right to sort of get their people in one at a time as openings happen. But they're not allowed to bump out the replacement workers with the exception of certain circumstances. And so this change to the law would take away the employer's right to have permanent replacements, which also makes it harder for the employer to keep running their business during a strike, because it's harder to hire people if you offer them just a temporary job versus a permanent job. So it takes away a lot of the employer's leverage. And there's the PRO Act would allow what's called intermittent strikes, or what, you know, which sometimes people call wildcat strikes. And so the board current precedent, current law basically prohibits that. It's not a protected strike. So you could fire people for doing that. But this would allow that, again, really changing the balance of power between management and labor. And also another tool that would be affected by the PRO Act is an employer's right to lock out workers. It doesn't happen very often, but an employer does have a right under the NLRA to say, you know what, we can't reach a deal with the union. We're going to lock them out. We're going to shut it down and nobody gets paid until we get what we want. And this PRO Act would limit the employer's ability to do that. Again, it's sort of a pretty significant change to the tilt of the playing field.
Well, I think that one thing's becoming more and more clear as we go through these elements, that there's nothing insignificant about the PRO Act at this point in time, that if this is legislation that's ultimately passed, there's going to be a vast sea change in how businesses are operating. I mean, something that I always find more lighthearted and always seems to be referred to when we're talking about unions is Scabby the Rat. And that large and inflatable rat that people sometimes see when we're dealing with strikes. It's my understanding that the PRO Act has language in it that's relevant to secondary strikes and boycotts, which is where we often see Scabby the Rat. Can you provide listeners with some background as to what secondary strikes or boycotts are, and then how the PRO Act's going to affect those strikes and boycotts?
Right. So the National Labor Relations Act, brings some order to disputes between a particular group of workers and a particular employer. So we call that one employer the primary employer. The board basically allows a lot of what they call, use of economic weapons against each other. You know, that would be strikes, that'd be lockouts, that's picketing, it's, handbilling of customers. So there's a lot of latitude for unions to engage in behavior that's pretty disruptive toward their primary employer. What is prohibited, however, is dragging in what's called a neutral employer, some third party that isn't part of the dispute. So that could be a vendor, could be a customer, so the board has tried to limit that kind of activity. So for instance, let's say you've got the Teamsters Union, which represents a bunch of truck drivers for a trucking company. They have a dispute. They can picket that trucking company at the terminal where the trucking company is, or they can follow them around and wherever they make a delivery, let's say it's to the local grocery store, they can picket at the grocery store as long as their primary target is there. But once that truck leaves, they can't picket the grocery store anymore because that's a secondary employer. It's neutral. The PRO Act would change that. Even if the truck's not there, you can have a picket line right out in front of the Hanford Brothers or some grocery store. Even if the beef, so to speak, is with the trucking company that services that grocery store from time to time. So this is a huge change in the rules. Secondary boycott rules have been litigated pretty significantly over the years as to how much can a union sort of push this boundary. Who's the primary employer? So is a joint employer a primary employer? Probably. You know, is a parent company the primary employer? It's not often. It can be, but generally not. Is a sister company, you know, let's say it's a non-union sister company, is that a primary employer? Depends, you know, but the issues have been litigated. But this essentially would throw all those cases out and just say, you know, fair game. You can go wherever you want.
So that means that even if you aren't a unionized employer, these are important for you to keep in mind. And I think that that continues to tell our listeners just how far reaching the PRO Act could be. And with that, we're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Man, do I love card night. You ready, boys? You got a king?
Go, Fish Dad!
Oh, come on! This is WWE superstar Titus O'Neil. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the proposed Protecting the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, and the top 10 elements of the act to keep in mind. We've talked about elements 1 through 6, and what's become clear, I think, to all of our listeners is the fact that this is a monumental shift in policy. And this is going to be affecting you whether you have a unionized environment or you're non-unionized. A big topic, Rob, that every employer has heard a lot about in the last decade, arbitration agreements. So currently, we know that employers can have mandatory arbitration agreements, but would the PRO Act affect an employer's right to continue to require mandatory arbitration?
It does. It will in a limited way, but significant. And this is an issue that relates to the use of mandatory arbitration agreements as a condition of employment that contain a particular kind of clause, namely a promise by the employee that they will arbitrate any class action claim they might have. And the unions have hated that language because they said, hey, this is concerted activity. If you've got people engaged in a class action lawsuit, typically say wage and hour, you know, And so this is an issue that unions are all over. And they said this is infringing on an employee's right to engage in concerted activity if you're prohibiting them from litigating class action lawsuits in court. And the U.S. Supreme Court held just a few years ago in the Epic Systems decision that these are lawful clauses, that having a clause in an arbitration agreement, and again, this is typically in a non-union context, so it's important for every employer to be aware of this. And I think more and more employers are recognizing that mandating arbitration of a class action law claim, such as a wage and hour claim, can be a significant tool in limiting your risk from wage and hour lawsuits, which can be devastating to the company. These wage and hour class actions can bet the company cases in many, many situations. We're talking, they can be millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, and that can have devastating consequences. And an arbitration is a way to at least control that kind of litigation. Unions have hated that, of course. And so this part of the PRO Act would essentially overrule the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Epic.
And I think it's so important, and you mentioned it, Rob, but like this is one of those elements that it's unionized and non-unionized. And so employers who are looking at the PRO Act and think that this is only about the National Labor Relations Act or it's only about unionization efforts really need to be mindful that this, if passed, would have a wide-reaching effect on all employers. So that's our seventh element is these mandatory arbitration agreements and how the PRO Act will affect employers' rights to limit those collective actions. Let's jump to something we talked about a little bit earlier when we were discussing terms and conditions of employment and how employees communicate with each other. And that's that question about employees using employer systems, specifically email servers and systems to work on union organizing campaigns or generally to do union work. Does the PRO Act touch on employees' ability to use employer materials for union activities?
Yeah, it sure does, and in a big way. The issue of union access to workers has been one that goes back decades. You know, how does a union find out the names and contact information for the people they want to represent? Historically, they've done it by hand billing outside the store or in the parking lot, or somebody gets them the call list from employees, and then the communications would flow from there. They'd have union meetings at the local restaurant or the union hall, and sort of in person typically would be the historic way of organizing. Of course, everything's changed in the last 20 years, with computers and email and social media. And so the board actually, at some point, well, after the petition is filed for an election, will require employers to turn over email addresses and telephone numbers and home addresses of the people in the unit. But the unions want to do all this work up front. They want to basically get in a position where the employer doesn't know what's happening and they organize secretly. And if they can get to the employer's email system, it's probably one of the best ways to reach people and to communicate with them. But historically, employers have said, oh, it's our equipment. We pay for it. We bought it. We can set rules on how to use it. And the board has flip-flopped on that position. Most of the time, the board has said, no, that's the employer's system. The union has enough ways to communicate with employees. And so they made a few exceptions that if there is no other way to for unions to communicate with potential members or its members, they would allow the use of the employer's email system. The PRO Act would basically sort of throw all that out. Employees can use the employer's email system for organizing, as long as they're doing their work. They're not supposed to be, it doesn't give them a license to goof off and not do their job. Although often that's a complaint that many employers will share with us. It's like, hey, they're spending all their time organizing and not doing their job. And then, of course, if you discipline them, then you get an unfair labor practice charge back at you for retaliating against the employee for their union activity. So, you have a lot of this behavior where you have employees essentially leading with their chin, say, come on, I dare you to hit me. And some employers can't resist the urge. So this would just make that, this would codify the board rule during the Obama administration that unions have a right and employees have a right to use employers' email systems to communicate and for union purposes.
So that's our seventh element, is this ability to use email systems of the employer for union activities. The eighth element, right before we go to a break, I don't think we have to spend a ton of time on, but I just want to touch on it really quickly. And that's regarding how arbitration agreements play a role in a different format. And that's regarding arbitrators and what they determine. Currently, if a union and an employer are unable to come to an agreement as to a collective bargaining agreement, it's my understanding that an employer is allowed to implement its last, best, and final offer if they have reached this legitimate bargaining impasse. But this would change under the PRO Act. Is that correct?
Yeah, it sure would. And this is primarily for the first contract. Let's say union is successfully elected to represent the members of a particular employer, and they have to sit down and bargain that first contract, which can be very challenging because you've got to start from scratch. Everything has to be negotiated, and under the current law, no party, the union or the employer, has to agree to anything. They just have to bargain in good faith, but they don't have to make any concessions. They don't have to agree. They just have to go through the process and bargain in good faith. And if you can't reach an agreement at the end of that process, then the union has the right to strike. The employer has the right to lock out. And then each side flexes their economic muscles to see who's got more determination and grit. This proposal would essentially short circuit that outcome of a sort of a deadlock or impasse, as we call it in labor relations, when you can't agree on a contract, even if both sides are negotiating in good faith. In this proposal, after 90 days of negotiating, if you can't reach a deal, either party can essentially invoke this process where three arbitrators will be appointed, one by the union, one by the company, and then a third so-called neutral arbitrator, and they'll decide your contract for you. They'll decide what you're going to get. It's a huge sea change. Some companies and unions will voluntarily agree to this kind of system, like called interest arbitration, but not many. Well, some do, but it would be a real sea change for first contracts in the private sector.
And with that, you have element number 9 of the big elements that we need to keep an eye on should the PRO Act be passed. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the proposed Protecting the Right to Organize or PRO Act and the top 10 elements of the act to keep in mind. Rob has provided us with elements 1 through 9, and we're going to talk about element 10 before we wrap things up. But I think for those of you who have been with us for the whole show, you recognize and understand that this is a monumental change. If this act is passed, we are going to see significant changes to both unionized work environments and environments that may be working towards a union or attempting to maintain a non-unionized standard. Rob, the last element I want to talk about is remedies and issues. You had talked previously about unfair labor practice charges being filed or the parties not coming to an agreement. Is there a change in remedies or penalties that would be available for violation of the National Labor Relations Act or other unionization rights?
Yeah, there sure is. The remedies are going to be vastly expanded for the unions and their members. And when I say remedies, I'm talking about what can the board give them, or what can the union or employees get if they successfully show that the employer has broken the National Labor Relations Act. Currently, the remedies are rather limited under the NLRA. So for the most part, it's back pay. If you terminate an employee because of, say, union activity, you got to reinstate them and pay them their back wages and essentially make them whole. Another kind of remedy would be essentially returning to the status quo. Let's say the employer terminated a health insurance plan without bargaining with the union first, and the premiums went up, you know, so the union squawks and said, hey, now we have to pay an extra couple hundred thousand in premiums for our members. And, you know, you didn't do that with bargaining with us. You just did it on your own. You know, so the employer went, okay, here's a couple hundred thousand, to essentially return to the status quo, if you will. The PRO Act just adds a whole new buffet of remedies. So employees now can sue in their own rights. They don't have to rely on the union. The union typically is the party in any of these lawsuits or proceedings at the board. They represent their member, and there may be an individual member that they're grieving over. Let's say it's a termination, but it's the union that's the party. This would allow employees to sue in their own right and in court, and they can get back wages. They can get now like double damages for liquidated damages over the other damages that they might be awarded. So essentially triple recovery. They don't have to, there's no offset allowed for things like unemployment or wages from another job. So they can essentially double dip or get a windfall. You can get front pay. There's also civil penalties that can be assessed against employers for $50,000 for violating a board order. If you're a repeat offender, it's $100,000. And also personal liability. So if you're a director or an officer, you're involved in, you know, essentially allowing an unfair labor practice to occur or doing it yourself, you're on the hook for all these damages that I just described. And if you're dealing with a big group of workers, you know, that's essentially the same as a class action. There can be huge amounts of liability that now flow from a violation of the National Labor Relations Act, which completely changes the risk assessment that a company has to go through when they're dealing with these issues with a union. And sometimes it's, you know, we'll have a situation as well. Who would you rather get sued by? Your customer who complained about your unionized truck driver who insulted them, who demands that that person get fired? Or would you rather deal with an unfair labor practice charge? And most of the time we're like, deal with the charge. That's like, there's not a lot of money at stake, you know, and keep your customer happy. But boy, this PRO Act would completely change that analysis. So it's another really significant change to the Act, and it really elevates the significance of employers' need to really pay attention to what's going on with this bill.
Well, I think in the last hour, Rob, it's fair to say that you've definitely helped me, and I hope our listeners understand that if this law is passed, how significant the changes will be. Thank you so much for your time and offering your wisdom and knowledge base to help all of us understand both what the current standard is and what we would be looking at for sea changes should the PRO Act be put into effect or passed by Congress. So thank you again.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.